like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest was to be John Katz, the New York Times bestselling author, most recently of The Second Chance Dog, A Love Story. But John canceled last night. He has bronchitis, no voice, and is probably at the doctor as we speak. I'm delighted to report that now our guest today will be Ellen Jaffe Jones, the running coach, cooking instructor, and author of the enormously popular book Eat Vegan on $4 a Day. Her new book is Kitchen Divided, Vegan Dishes for Semi-Vegan Households, a guide and cookbook for families and other homes where some folks are vegan and some folks aren't. We'll discuss the new book and some of the guidance and recipes therein, which may be somewhat timely on the eve of Thanksgiving. And we speak with Ellen Jaffe Jones in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later in today's show, we'll have a brief chat with Skip Haynes, who runs the Laurel Canyon Animal Company, a Los Angeles record label that creates music about, for, and with animals, including their new release, Bring an Animal Home for the Holidays. Also, towards the end of today's show, and Name That Animal Tune, we'll be offering as the prize a copy of Ellen Jaffe Jones' new book, Kitchen Divided. We'll get to all this later in the program. First, let's hear an animal song. This is Cat Stevens with I Love My Dog. I'm Talking Animals.
I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may think my dog will always come through. All he asks from me is the food to give him strength. All he ever needs is love, and that he knows he'll get. So I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may think my dog will always come through. All the pay I need comes a shining through his eyes. I don't need no cold water to make me realize that I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may fade, my dog will always come through. As much as I love you, but you may think my dog will always come through.
This is Cat Stevens with I Love My Dog, an animal song to get us started this morning. And now with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Ellen Jaffe Jones back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Sure.
So Eat Vegan on $4 a day is proven wildly popular and not coincidentally enormously successful as well, and still seems like kind of your signature book in a sense, looking at your online presence, your website, Facebook pages, etc. We did discuss this book in detail on the show 2 years ago, almost to the day, by the way. But for those listening who might not have heard that discussion or simply just aren't as aware of the book, why don't you just give us a brief lowdown on Eat Vegan?
I wrote it because I spent 18 years in TV news as a consumer reporter, so I had a working knowledge of the consumer price index and food prices. And then I spent 5 years at Smith Barney as a financial consultant, and I just got so tired of seeing all these stories on the news that said you can't eat well on a budget. And the original title was actually Eat Well on $3 a Day, so that tells you how many years I was trying to get this book done.
Yeah.
And every recipe in the book has a price estimated based on the cost of ingredients that you can find at any big box store or grocery store. And people say, you know, oh, are you suggesting we shop at big box stores? And I go, you know, it's just wherever you can afford to shop. And the reality is 1 out of 6 people live below the poverty level of $23,000 a year. So they're already shopping there. And I just wanted to crunch the numbers and show you really can do it.
And so why, I mean, you know, in a way, what you've just mentioned probably partially at least answers the question, but nonetheless, why do you think the book clicked to the degree that it did? I mean, it really took off. It really obviously spoke to a lot of people in a profound way.
Yeah, you know, I laugh because I just came back this weekend from the Miami Book Fair, which was my second year being there as my publisher's only author, and we just sold 100 books like that, you know, compared to the next seller, which was maybe 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason is, as somebody said last year, and this is the quote I remember most in answer to your question, is, I don't know about vegan, but you had me at $4 a day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's it. You know, when I worked at Smith Barney, I found that companies who claimed they were socially responsible, doing great things for the environment and employee benefits. And, you know, my expertise there was also getting clients to invest in companies that didn't test on animals for clients who wanted that screen. But companies didn't really care about all that. But if you could show them, for example, how they could recycle not only their own company's cans, but other companies' cans, then all of a sudden, they could say in their annual report, I'm socially responsible. So I always felt like it was, if you could reach people through their pocketbooks, through their wallets, and show them how much money they could save, not only at the grocery store, but you take that $100,000 bypass surgery and dollar cost average it over the course of your lifetime of eating hamburgers at $5 at a restaurant, say, and that's really like a $1,000 burger. And that last quote was something I said on a video at the Dr. McDougall Advanced Study Week. And for those of you who don't know, he's got this great clinic out in Santa Rosa where people come like about ready to die, and he brings them back to health through his plant-based diet and all the 30 years he's been doing all this. But I was a guest chef out there, and they did an interview with me, and I said that, and sure enough, that became like the headline, the subject line in one of the newsletters they sent out, the $1,000 hamburger.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it does seem, as you've kind of noted here, that the book, you know, provides very, very important information, very desired information, and it addresses and sort of combats the notion that embracing a vegan diet is expensive. Not to mention the people that you know already noted that couldn't care less about the vegan part, but just were struck by the $4 part. But
right. And, you know, people ask me all the time, "How do you do it?" And my 5-second television answer is: beans, grains, and greens. Shop in bulk. Shop the perimeter of the store, and that's it. It's not rocket science.
Yeah, well, so now Kitchen Divided has been out, I guess, the better part of 6 months now. And how would you characterize the reaction to this book so far?
Well, I would say at the Miami Book Fair, it kept up the pace with Eat Vegan, and that's because there are so many new vegans now who have come to the vegan table pretty much by themselves after they've watched a really incredible movie like Forks Over Knives, something like that, mm-hmm. or they've read a great book, and they often do it by themselves. And on an island where nobody else in their family does this, and they're kind of scratching their heads like, well, how do I get other people involved in doing this? So I wrote Kitchen Divided because I didn't want people to keep feeling like they were short order chefs. You know, when you have to prepare different meals for family members, it can get very frustrating and in some cases, you know, build up resentment over a period of time. So all of the recipes are divided into various categories. So you would have like entrees that you could eat as a vegan, but the meat eater could throw whatever they want to throw into it. Or there could be side dishes for the meat eater, but those could be your main dishes. So the idea was to simplify your life and to make it really easy or easier to do this if you live with other people who don't eat the way you do.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point because I think a lot of times people, when they think about vegans and they might sort of have this view almost sort of like that it's sort of an insular world that the vegans hang out with each other, they live with each other, they're in relationships with each other, which is, as you note, and of course is the very point of the book, is not necessarily the case. That's the case in some instances, of course, but as you say, as more and more folks sort of join the vegan ranks, they are living with someone, whether it's in the family or just sharing a living space in some other arrangement or whatever, with people who have a very different view about what they want to eat and why. So, yeah, it's an interesting sort of territory to negotiate. So what was the, you kind of touched on why generally, but was there sort of more of a personal impetus for writing Kitchen Divided?
Well, you know, I've heard Dr. Neil Barnard, who I know you've had on your show a few times. He talks about being the youngest in his family, and I am struck as I am out there on the lecture circuit how many of us are the youngest in our families, because I think we've had plenty of opportunities, like our whole lives, to see what works and what doesn't work. And actually, my husband is not vegan. We met at a time, we were both TV investigative reporters in Miami, and we have a lot of other things in common. And as I said in Eat Vegan, it's more important to have somebody who loves and respects you than a clone at the dinner table. And if you've ever been in a bad marriage, you know, you can really understand why there are other things that make a relationship work long term. And it's important to have that respect and appreciation. And you would love to bring everybody with you. And people say this to me all the time, like, hasn't everybody in your family, when they see that you, you know, this past summer, since I was on your show last year, I placed seventh in the National Senior Games for my age group in the 1,500 meters, and came in 10th in the 400 meters, 16th in the 200 meters. I placed locally in the Tampa area in 58 5K races for my age group. So, you know, people are always saying, well, how come everybody else in your family just doesn't jump on the bandwagon? And it's just not that easy all the time.
Mm-hmm. So within your family, how does the vegan, non-vegan population stack up?
Oh, I have been all my life a black sheep and cult member.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not with my husband. I mean, he totally gets it, but he is 18 years older than me, mm-hmm. and you know, we talk very openly about this. He is on a number of drugs for diseases of affluence, and he has tried, but, you know, it just, for whatever reason, you know, it just isn't there. And I taught cooking classes for a number of years before, for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, before my books came out.
Yeah.
And I found this, that it's often the older you get, it's just harder to change, unless you are faced with a life-altering disease that maybe gives you some kind of epiphany. But, you know, for me, I always grew up, my mom, aunt, both sisters had breast cancer, and I always, from a very young age, when my aunt died in our home when I was 5, I kept thinking, how do I avoid this mess? What is the truth about food? And as I said in Eat Vegan, when you understand there's no money in broccoli, then you understand why you have to be your own investigative reporter to figure this out. Who's paying for the study? You know, what corporation made the product you're buying? Those kinds of questions.
Sure. Well, and so if I'm not mistaken, too, you have daughters, and did they share, as they were looking at kind of the genetic hand they were dealt, did they share the sort of concern and then the decision that you made?
I think that they did not grow up in the same environment I did, which was seeing all these people get sick and die. I mean, they've seen some of that, but mm-hmm. Also, without going there too much, you know, we came out of a divorce situation, so food, as it often is, was even more of a battleground.
Okay.
But my oldest daughter has been vegetarian. She is an artist in London and does a lot of animal drawings. Is very successful at what she does. And my middle daughter remembers our organic garden and complains that tomatoes just don't taste the way they did in the organic garden. So I've planted those seeds.
Yeah.
They're still relatively young. And
sure.
I'm hoping that, you know, I was 28 before I picked up my first vegan book.
Mm-hmm.
So, and almost died. And that's what got me there. And, you know, I do this for animal rights, too. As being a TV investigative reporter, I covered some of the worst animal abuse stories at the time when I was in Miami. And so all of this shapes who we become.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting, though, because I was thinking about the books, you know, and your lectures and things that you do at various veg fests and other events. And to me, it seems that your talks and your books about veganism and embracing it yourself seem to be more propelled more by kind of the health medical stance that you just alluded to than from an animal standpoint, which naturally is the more... Okay.
Yeah, the reason for that, and you raised an excellent point, but when I worked in television news, the only time I ever saw PETA or any animal rights group get coverage was when they did something outrageous in front of the fur company. And I can't tell you how many times, Duncan, I would bring somebody to be interviewed. I would actually record the interview, and it would just die on the news director's desk. And I've always been thinking, how do I reach people? How do I get news coverage? How do I make these issues stand out to the news director that I always had to face, who would say, well, good news doesn't sell, only bad news.
Mm.
And that's really the mentality still of newsroom.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking at it from that perspective, but that doesn't mean I don't have the animal rights passion
mm-hmm.
that all of us who have been at this table for a fairly long time do.
Sure. Well, again, and people come to embrace veganism from different angles. Sometimes those paths converge, sometimes they don't, but it is interesting that there's as much the medical health issue, at least overtly from your standpoint, as the other. But now in Kitchen Divided, there's a kind of a lot of suggested approaches in the front of the book for how vegans and non-vegans living in the same household can negotiate the culinary and philosophical, really, divide. And maybe we'll circle back to some of those in a moment. But since Thanksgiving is tomorrow, and for many people a day that revolves around eating, it might be useful and kind of timely to just make the book discussion very specific for a moment and just ask you to describe some Kitchen Divided scenarios for tomorrow.
As far as recipes go, you mean?
Yeah, recipes, how that might play out from a Kitchen Divided standpoint. I mean, for example, for vegans not able to go to something like Thanks Vegan, which we'll get into a bit later in the show, if not more immediately. It's this, they're doing the 8th annual one here in Tampa. And people gather and bring, you know, vegan dishes, and that's, you know, how they spend their afternoon. But otherwise, if you're not in a position to enjoy something like that, and you're just going to someone's home, or you're hosting people, you know, what are some key strategies to employ? And again, what are some key recipes, even in a Kitchen Divided, that you might think would be particularly helpful or useful for people?
Sure. You know, I actually am going to one of those events myself where I will be the only lone vegan. And I look at these, as I always have throughout my life, an opportunity to educate and inspire others who maybe don't give it a second thought or have some kind of judgment about what eating vegan is like. And if you can prepare some of the most delicious dishes you can come up with, that's often a way, you know, through their stomach and their senses to reach them. So as far as tomorrow goes, there, and in terms of being more traditional, I have a sweet potato kale casserole, and you can incorporate, you know, the sweet potato, which is often at the Thanksgiving table, into a dish that maybe the non-vegans will think, well, that looks remotely familiar. So, you know, the only thing that is a little different, of course, might be the kale. And this recipe calls for optional 2 cups of chopped vegan turkey, which I promise you they'll never know is in there, and a cup of shredded vegan cheese. And a lot of people who are not vegan don't realize that there are some pretty delicious cheese alternatives versus when I started out 32 years ago, and the only choice you had was really disgusting soy cheese. So you just have to experiment with the different cheeses and see, you know, if that is maybe one way to their hearts and their stomachs. And in this recipe, it also includes chopped tomatoes and tomato paste and a can of coconut milk. And basically, you just put them all together, spread one-third of the mixture in a baking pan, and arrange half of the sweet potatoes on top, and then top with a little kale. And you just layer the casserole dish like that and bake for 30 minutes. Another recipe that I love, and this is, you know, I always love the wow factor when people go, I can't believe it's vegan.
Mm-hmm.
So mushrooms and lentils in a phyllo dough. And this is actually modified from an egg-based recipe and using energy egg replacer instead of the egg. So this would be using long grain brown rice and some green lentils. Cook them separately and then line a bowl with the phyllo dough. And, you know, phyllo dough can be a little tricky to work with, but once you get used to it, it really is quite quite easy. And you just coat it in, a lot of recipes will say to coat it with butter, but we use oil here to keep the sheets from drying out and separated.
Mm-hmm.
So you just put some phyllo dough in the bottom of a bowl, an oven-safe bowl, or a casserole dish, and then just layer with the lentils and the other ingredients I have, which include just some mushrooms and spiced up with dill, parsley, and some vegetable broth. I love keeping a stash of vegetable broth, the powdered stuff, I get it from Whole Foods, and that lasts forever.
Your vegetable broth is powdered, is that what you said?
Oh, yeah, veggie-based.
Okay.
Yeah, and it doesn't have any preservatives or anything. It comes in a can, and I buy a ginormous can at Whole Foods once a year, and it will last me all year. You just add a tablespoon to 8 ounces of water, and it tastes like anything you can buy in the aseptic packages, but it really tastes quite fresh, and so I like that.
Cool.
And then there's another one, Quiche Your Troubles Goodbye.
Well, just on the wordplay alone, it's got to be a successful dish. Yeah.
And then there are always the traditional zucchini boats or squash boats that you can fill up with vegetables. Quinoa paella is another one that's really yummy. And can be very festive this time of year. And there are all these vegan meat alternatives like kielbasa and vegan turkey, that kind of stuff, if you want to add it.
Sure. Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Ellen Jaffe Jones, author most recently of Kitchen Divided, Vegan Dishes for Semi-Vegan Households. If you'd like to ask Ellen a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. And we, in a sense, we've kind of already covered some of this, but I just want to read you an email that they came in, Ellen, the subject line says, I hear ya. And then it says, great guest. I live in a house divided three ways. My 10-year-old loves meat. Husband is vegan. And I find myself having to think too much about dinner items. The book has so many great ideas and recipes. Do you have particular favorites that would be good for Thanksgiving, which we've just touched on? Thank you. Thank you for writing it. So, but, you know, one thing, too, that you know, it seems so obvious, it's kind of, you know, maybe not even worth noting. But really, for a lot of people, and you get used to thinking in these terms over the years, is that really, you know, if you go almost anywhere to anybody's house on Thanksgiving, once you sort of pull the turkey or the ham or whatever out, so many of the rest of the great dishes that people also love are right down the, at least the vegetarian, but often just the vegan path.
Absolutely. And I see nothing wrong with just offering a ton of vegetables, roasted vegetables on a platter, because people fill up with all the heavy food and then they feel, you know, so drugged almost afterwards. You know, one of the most amazing things that I learned at when I was the guest chef at the McDougal weekend is that sugar is more addictive than cocaine, the way it responds on an MRI. On a brain scan. And,
yeah.
You know, that's just amazing that it can be so powerful. So having healthy alternatives or just some alternatives other than all the typical Thanksgiving stuff that makes us feel so sluggish afterwards is just great.
And some of it's just a matter of programming or reprogramming. Because, again, you know, if someone had heard what I said a moment ago and said, well, yeah, you know, if you just take the turkey out or the ham or whatever, and you know, so much of the rest is perfect in that regard, they say, well, yeah, but, you know, where's the meat, basically? Or, you know, like it would be lacking if it didn't have that at the centerpiece. And but again, that's just because most of us are programmed that way growing up, but But often you hear people after they've had a great Thanksgiving dinner that day or the next day, they're recounting it. And so much of the time you hear about the other dishes. Those are things that people tend to be raving about.
Exactly. And this really is an opportunity, not that you would want to make a steady diet of the faux meats, but tofurkey, of course, and field roast. I always hear great things about both of them in terms of what they offer for meat alternatives or turkey alternatives on Thanksgiving is just a great way to introduce the idea that a vegan diet doesn't have to deprive you of anything. But when you think about it, there's like hundreds of fruits and vegetables out there, all different colors of the rainbow. And in fact, one of my tips, one of my many tips along the way is to eat outside, because there's something about food and sunlight, especially the produce, that really pops out. You know, when you go to a farmer's market outside on a Saturday morning and you see all those beautiful colors, it's the same idea. And in the animal kingdom, it's pretty much brown, brown, and brown.
Yeah. Well, and also, too, you know, back to the thing about, hey, where's the turkey, where's the ham? You know, one of the things that you cite here early in the book is sort of the age-old question that comes up when people are even faced with the idea of, like, thinking about embracing a vegan diet, is like, well, geez, so, you know, how would I possibly get my protein? I mean, it's sort of almost a gag at this point. But, I mean, you do talk about it in the book. And so there's some obvious ways where you can get protein. But, I mean, I think until people really dove into stuff, they wouldn't necessarily think that, like, broccoli, for example, as a great source of protein, or spinach. I mean, you would sort of think, okay, you know, beans, legumes, nuts, seeds, okay, sure, that makes sense to me. But some of those things, until you really sort of delve into it, you wouldn't necessarily think, well, that's, hey, those are great sources of protein when you put a nice serving of spinach in front of yourself, or broccoli, or things like that.
Absolutely. And if you've read the landmark book, The China Study, you'll know how greatly overrated protein is. And I always ask my audiences, how many of you have met somebody who's been diagnosed with a protein deficiency? And, of course, nobody will raise their hands. And then I'll go, how many of you know somebody who's been diagnosed with diabetes, heart disease, or cancer? And, of course, everybody raises their hand. So it's this idea of we get stuck in these myths that just can be pretty much irrelevant, because you are going to get protein from so many different sources. Tempeh is a delicious product that's available at Publix and just about any grocery store now, and it's so cool to see things that you could only get at a health food store are now making their way into the mainstream stores. And, of course, quinoa is very high in protein and iron, and
yeah,
it's a delicious grain that has more protein in it than any other grain out there, and it has so much protein that they even extract it and put it in powdered athletic recovery drinks, which, when you think about it, is kind of funny that we are, you know, you just want to scream out and say, like, just eat the natural food.
Right, as is. Yeah. As
oh
is. And speaking of that, more than a few times in the book, or the books, really, you do sort of note the, and you mentioned it a moment ago, sort of the substitute meats or faux meats, whatever, more, it sounds like, really, from your standpoint, as a transitional basis into vegan eating. Is there a medical or other reason from your standpoint that people would only want to do that sort of in a fleeting sense or as a transitional step?
Well, I think it's always a great idea to be eating foods in their natural state. And I have long been saying, what did our ancestors really do? What did Mother Nature intend? And when you start processing foods, we often have a habit of shooting first and asking questions later. Not that there are any problems with some of the plant-based faux meats, or there's even vegan prawns now, which is just a hoot. So you can put them in a salad, and just, you know, often the meat eaters really won't realize that you've got a vegan alternative. So these are great transitional foods, but I always talk about eating foods in their natural states. In fact, my next book, which should come off the press in a few more months, is going to be dealing with our current paleo trend, without getting into that too much. But, you know, I'm just all about blowing up myths that people have, that you have to make it complicated or difficult. But there are all these alternatives out there just to get you started and to give you a taste of what the huge variety and boundless opportunities and amazing benefits of eating a vegan diet can provide. And it's so much better for the environment. I don't know if you saw the headline yesterday, but Al Gore finally has gone vegan.
Yeah, well, you know, I was in fact going to bring that up because he did make that announcement. And one of the things that's interesting is there really seems to be sort of different schools of thought about the meaning and value of a high-profile figure going vegan. And you look at sort of certain Facebook pages or message boards, and it's really divided. Maybe you could talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, I totally hear you. And I got that as soon as I posted. Like, there were all these comments saying, well, we're going to live by this celebrity and die by this celebrity. And then, you know, when he comes off of it, we're all going to be regretful that we gave him this much publicity. And my response is really, hey, you know, give the guy a chance. Look at what Bill Clinton has done for the vegan community and to inspire so many people. If just one person picks up a vegan book or watches a vegan movie and begins to start asking the questions that we all did when we started, because most of us, I don't think, were born into a vegan family. And if you were, amazing. Congratulations. That's awesome. But, you know, you have to start somewhere. And there are healthy ways to do any kind of diet out there. And it, for many of us, it's just a lifelong quest of trying to figure out what works best. And so I was glad to see some of the publicity out there on it, because I think it just helps give more credibility. And especially from an environmental perspective, there is nothing more. I'm sure, you know, you've probably talked about this on your show, or at least in your circles, that the United Nations has said basically that eating a vegan diet does more to reduce your carbon footprint than stopping driving altogether. So if Al Gore can get this message, then hopefully many more people can too.
Yeah, and really, I mean, back to the Clinton thing, I mean, this, so many conversations we've had on Talking Animals over the years, President Clinton at least has been cited repeatedly as a huge plus. I mean, most recently, my conversation with Dr. Milton Mills, just, again, the influence, and I guess maybe more so in his case, A, it's President Clinton, but B, because of his heart troubles and other things, and then when you see him, he looks so svelte and healthy and great that I just, you know, I guess I have been surprised off and on to hear the downside of a noted figure announcing that, although I know what you mean about then if somebody sort of, you know, swings back the other direction. And I guess even Clinton has always kind of acknowledged it now and again, he will have fish. But I just have been surprised that there's like some grousing about things like that. And then the Al Gore announcement as well.
Yeah, I think you just have to take all of that in social media with a grain of salt.
Sure. Yeah.
And certainly the larger you get in terms of your audience, I'm sure you've experienced this, you just tend to attract more people who will jump in with either negativity or positive comments, and you just sort of have to let it flow and ride. And that's the beauty of social media, is that so many people can participate and engage. And it's all about getting people to think about their food choices and remove this disconnect that happens when you go to the grocery store and then end up with meat on your plate 3 times a day. It's just not necessary. One of the better quotes I've heard recently is that even mountain lions don't eat animal protein 3 times a day. They're lucky if they get it once every 2 weeks.
There you go. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Ellen Jaffe Jones, author most recently of Kitchen Divided, Vegan Dishes for Semi-Vegan Households. We're just in the final moment or two of our conversation with Ellen, but if you'd like to quickly join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. So Ellen, you made reference. In fact, when I called you yesterday, it sounded like you were sort of busily editing the next book, and it sounds like you're not ready to talk about it too much, but it sounds like it's in the home stretch, done, and just about ready to go to press. How do you, you know, between now, you know, Kitchen Divided, Eat Vegan, and now this new one that you've finished, I mean, how do you view your sort of, at least what seems from the outside, like reinvention as an author? I mean, are you sort of surprised? Does it make sense looking at the kind of continuum of your career that this is where you find yourself? Or how do you look at it?
Yes and no. I think I knew from an early age, being the only healthy person in my family of origin, that things were going to start happening as I became more outspoken about how I do what I do. And that people really seem to have an interest in how do you get to be 61, as I am, and look like that. And, you know, I think it's a magical combination of a vegan diet, a healthy, balanced, natural vegan diet with exercise, specifically running, that becomes so magical. And so I'm happy to share this. And of course, as you've probably also picked up from this conversation, it's about my three daughters. We were part of the original breast cancer gene studies. And the reality is, the odds are, genetic odds are, one in four of us will get cancer. And I hope that it doesn't happen. And my work really is about, not about making money, but about leaving a legacy and trying to not only improve my kids' lives, but their whole generation, the world in which they live, to make it a more peaceful, loving, compassionate, and more humane world, because we have so many problems. And I think so many of them, I mean, not to say that eating vegan is the cure-all, but it sure could help a lot of situations out there.
Well, that might be the perfect point at which to leave, especially as we brush up against Thanksgiving Day. So we've been speaking with Ellen Jaffe Jones. Her new book is Kitchen Divided, Vegan Dishes for Semi-Vegan Households. Her website is vegcoach.com. And there's Facebook pages not only for the new book, Kitchen Divided, which you can just find at facebook.com/kitchendivided, but of course also for Eat Vegan on $4 a Day. So Ellen, thank you so much for joining us again on Talking Animals.
My pleasure, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Same to you.
All right. In just a few minutes, we'll speak with Skip Haynes of the Laurel Canyon Animal Company, which creates music about, for, and get this, with animals. First, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is something new from the great Dana Gould, part of a piece called Animal Aftercare, on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
It's actually a little awkward for me to be up here talking about dogs. I'm not going to kid you. We had four dogs, and then now we have three dogs, because the dog I wanted to die the least died. I know, not a big momentum builder at the old comedy show. But, you know, so, it happens, and she was a great girl, 15 and a half, played hard to the bottom of the ninth, Bella, my dog. Just loved her to death. Well, no, I don't love her. That would have been terrible. Jeffrey Dahmer loved people to death. I just loved my dog a lot. And I'm with her, and all the kids are there, and we're at Animal Aftercare. Y'all know what happens there. And I have to say, I was very proud of everybody. Everybody had their moment. Everybody knew what was going on. We didn't bend anybody. I was really proud of everybody. And then they all went out to the car, and I was good. You know, I was kind of like hanging together until I actually had to hand her over, and then I fell apart. I started crying like a sissy who was also a girl. And the woman who worked there went, "Sir, it's okay. This happens every day." And all I could think of was, "Then why do you work here? What the f*** is wrong with you? What'd you tell your guidance counselor? Oh, I really like sad people, but I want to be around a lot of dead animals." Well, you got your wish. Congratulations, Dr. Frankenstein, you got your wish.
All right. That was Dana Gould, part of a piece called Animal Aftercare, taken from his brand new album, I Know It's Wrong. Here to tell us about the Laurel Canyon Animal Company, let's welcome Skip Haynes to Talking Animals. Good morning, Skip.
Duncan, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us, especially, again, we're speaking to you from the greater L.A. area, so it's bright and early, or at least early out there, so thanks for getting up to speak with us a little about the Laurel Canyon Animal Company. So why don't you at least just give us the nickel tour of what the Laurel Canyon Animal Company is?
Well, we've been around for about 10 years, and we're probably the only record company that creates music about, for, and with animals. And we're also probably the only record company that on many of our projects we use animal communicators. to involve animals directly in the creative process. So that, in a nutshell, is what we do.
Okay, and so it's the with part that I think people are intrigued by, creating music about, for, and with. So so what? Like, give us a quick example of a piece of music you've done or done recently that involved the animals' contribution.
Well, our favorite is called Songs to Make Dogs Happy, and we used an animal communicator and basically put focus groups of dogs together, and she tested them out, and we gave her different kinds of music to test with the dogs, and based on her translations, as we call it, we created the album. You know,
wow.
She tested it out with the dogs, and she would call us every weekend when she did it. She would go into shelters and her private consultations, and based on what the dogs said, per se, we created the album, and it was made specifically for dogs, you know. And so when we did it, we weren't really sure what we were doing, because I don't think anybody had ever done it before. And it turned out that dogs really liked this album. We got calls from people saying, calls and emails saying it would help dogs in thunderstorms, and we got calls from vets telling us it helped dogs in recovery, and shelters use it all over the country now to calm down dogs in the shelter. So it was quite an interesting situation.
So Skip, with that in mind, are most or even all of the CDs released by Laurel Canyon Animal Company aimed at least as much as at the dog listening audience as the human listening audience?
No, we have two CDs aimed specifically at dogs. One is also our Christmas CD. We have the whole CD is not aimed entirely at dogs, but there's several cuts on it that we use the communicators to test out with the dogs. And we have another CD called More Songs to Make Dogs Happy, because so many people, end quote, dogs, like the first one. And of course, you know, we create the music for people also, because dogs don't have credit cards.
Right, right. That's what I was thinking. You gotta reach the human audience too. Otherwise, sales are gonna drop precipitously, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. And we create all original music, and we go through a lot of trouble to get the music as good as we possibly can. My partner Dana Walden and I both been record producers for a long time. So
the Christmas album, that's a new effort, a new project.
Yes, it's fairly new. We just came out with it, and it's called Bring an Animal Home for the Holidays. And the song's actually about adopting an animal during the holidays, because a lot of people tend to get very emotional during Christmas and so forth.
Sure.
They don't realize that adopting a dog or any animal is a lifetime process. So that's kind of what it's about. And we developed it for shelters, because a lot of shelters, you know, have adoption events during holidays.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I'm going to touch on in a moment, which I mentioned a few times in recent shows, is that month of November, usually pretty much across the country, has sort of been designated as the month to particularly emphasize the adoption of black, either cats or dogs, just because,
right,
again, those are so neglected at shelters. So we're in the tail end of that. But this sounds cool. So where could people find out more about the Laurel Canyon Animal Company and or the CDs? And again, if they were inclined, where what are some of the places where they might purchase one or more CDs?
They can go to our website, which is petcds.com. All our stuff's also available on, you know, iTunes and all the digital platforms.
Okay.
And they could also, you know, they can test it out if they go to our website. If you bring your dog into the room and you go to our website, particularly in Songs to Make Dogs Happy, there's a song called Squeaky Deaky in particular.
Yeah.
And if you play it for your dog, you can test it out yourself. You'll see how your dog will react to the song.
Well, I'm quite a bit of distance from my dog right now. So, can you give me a little hint of what we might expect when a dog hears Squeaky Deaky?
Well, you know, a lot of the dogs will jump up and get their squeaky toys. Sometimes, once in a while, they run out of the room, but that's 1 out of 50.
Yeah, not the reaction you're going for in your own private canine focus group there.
No, it's true, but most, I would say, you know, 40 to 50% of the dogs that hear this will really like it.
Cool.
And noticeably.
Yeah.
And we also, you know, there's instructions on the CD. They're very simple. We just tell people, you know, play this once a day for your dog for a week or two, and just make sure you're in the room or in your car or wherever with the animal, because they will learn to associate that music in particular with quality time with you. So, and it tends to work for separation anxiety in that aspect then. Many other things.
Wow, very cool. Well, gosh, Skip, thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals and filling us in. Again, this has been Skip Haines of Laurel Canyon Animal Company. The website is petcds.com. Thanks again, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Same to you, Duncan.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Ellen Jaffe Jones' new book, Kitchen Divided. We'll get to that in a moment or two here on Talk Animals. Right now, though, it's time for some animal news and announcements, starting with a huge piece that probably seen or have seen other media coverage sort of emerged from it. But anyways, The Hollywood Reporter did a gigantic sort of expose called Animals Were Harmed, really looking at the whole American Humane Association and how they monitor or don't monitor TV shows and especially films that then later get no animals were harmed kind of a thing. I'm just going to read the beginning to give you a sense of this. American Humane Association monitor Gina Johnson confided in an email to a colleague on April 7, 2011 about the star tiger in Ang Lee's Life of Pi. While many scenes featuring Richard Parker, the Bengal tiger who shares a lifeboat with a boy lost at sea, were created using CGI technology, King, very much a real animal, was employed when the digital version wouldn't suffice. Quote, "This one take with him just really went bad and he got lost trying to swim to the side," Johnson wrote. "Damn near drowned." That's how the piece opens. And anyway, I really recommend checking this out online if you haven't already seen it. And again, the local media, especially in LA, and Piers Morgan, I think, did a brief segment last night and other things. So anyway, kind of hair-raising, but important information to get out there. So on a much happier note, saw this in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, the day before, Dateline Monterey, California. The headline is, "With Extra Anchovies, Deluxe Whale Watching." It begins, began with the anchovies, miles and miles of them, their silvery blue bodies thick in the waters of Monterey Bay. Then the sea lions came by the thousands from up and down the California coast, and the pelicans arriving in one long V formation after another. Fleets of bottlenose dolphins joined them, but it was the whales that astounded even longtime residents. More than 200 humpbacks, lunging, breaching, blowing, and tail flapping, and on a recent weekend, a pod of 19 rowdy orcas that briefly crashed the party, picking off sea lions along the way. "I can't tell you where to look," Nancy Black, a marine biologist leading a boat full of whale watchers, said last week. "In the water, in every direction, roiled with animals, it's all around." Anyways, the story goes on, but it's just sort of this unprecedented activity, as sort of initially described there, based on the particularly unprecedented late bloom of anchovies in that area. So anyways, also really a good read. You can find it online, New York Times. A little bit lighter, kookier notes. Well, actually, we'll come back to that if we have time. But made reference to in our conversation with Ellen, and I've mentioned it a couple other times in recent shows, is that there's the tomorrow's the 8th annual Thanks Vegan Potluck happening here in Tampa. There's a social part from 1:30 to 2, and then the potluck dinner itself from 2 to 5 p.m. taking place at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tampa, 11400 Morris Bridge Road in Tampa itself. Everyone is welcome. Basically, of course, it's a chance to share vegan dishes, and there's all different formats if you can bring dishes, and if you can't, what you would pay and how that would work. So to find out more, and hopefully there's still space, you can go to thanksvegan.com, or they're also on Facebook. At Thanks Vegan. And that's probably going to do it. Oh, actually, quickly, because this is the last one for a while. The folks at Dunedin Dog Rescue let me know that their last dog wash for about 3 months is coming up this Sunday, December 1st, at Pinehurst Pub Courtyard in Dunedin. And there'll be, of course, dog washes, nail and ear cleaning, live music, consultations with trainers, mobile vaccine clinics, and much, much more. Sounds like a huge, great afternoon out there. So check DunedinDogs.com or again on Facebook at Dog Eden for more details. All right, I think that is all we have time for today. I am Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WMNF member to win, and there will be a prize, a copy of Ellen Jaffe Jones' new book, Kitchen Divided, to the first person calls in and can name this animal tune at 813-239-9663. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
One night Farmer Brown was taking the air, locked up the barnyard with greatest of care. Down in the hen house something stirred, when he hollered, "Who there?" This is what he heard: "Ain't nobody here but us chicken. It ain't nobody here at all. So calm yourself."
All right. If people call in with guesses, we'll probably have to take those off the air. I am Duncan Strauss. We have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll be back next Wednesday with another edition. Hope you'll join me then. Also, all our Facebook, Twitter, and other information can be found at talkinganimals.net. Should mention that later today I'll be filling in for Scott Elliott doing the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Hope you'll join me for that today from 1 to 4 p.m. on WMNF. I am Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. I want to wish you and yours a very happy Thanksgiving. And let's actually gild the lily here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Ain't nobody here but us chickens.
That's exactly right. What is your first name, ma'am?
Oh, good. My name is Sarah.
Sarah?
Yeah.
Okay, sir, I'm going to put you on hold. You are our winner. You'll get a copy of Ellen Jaffe Jones' new book, Kitchen Divided. So stay on the line. I'll come get your information.
Okay, great.
Thanks. All right, we do have a winner. Sarah knew that it was. Ain't nobody here but us chickens. You bet. All right. Ain't nobody here but us turkeys and chickens and whatever, conceivably. So anyways, we have just about reached the end. It's WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Weeky Watchy, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Happy Thanksgiving once again to you and yours. And we'll catch you up with you again at 1 p.m. here on 88.5 FM, WMNF.